Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam and I are going to talk with Dr. Howard Cedar, head of the Faculty of the Medicine Department of Developmental Biology and Cancer Research at Hebrew University, about epigenetics. It's more than just genes. He is known as the father of DNA methylation, and we'll learn what that is. And looking forward to that conversation, Adam. But first, Adam, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about another study on ADHD showing writing problems.
Writing problems. We're going to look at this whole, not the controversy, but we're going to look at some research on circumcision and what it might inform the controversy.
And some studies related to kidney failure, one about the experience of people on dialysis and a couple about kidney organ donations.
That's right. Well, let's look into this very first one about attention deficit hyperactivity disorders. We actually dealt with a question last week from a listener, Christy, about its diagnosis. And here there's some interesting research about handwriting and this diagnosis of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
And we know this is common. Close to 10% of kids age 4 to 17 have ADHD. And this was a study published in the Journal of Pediatrics looking at 6,000 children born between 1976 and 1982 and showed that these kids were more likely to have problems with writing, problems like poor spelling and grammar, than their peers who did not have ADHD.
In addition to writing, they also had reading problems. But this was really pretty amazing, Christy, because compared to those who did not have it, let's say in boys, only 1 in 6 might have had this sort of writing-reading problem. Those with ADHD, almost 66%. So, you know, 4 or 5 times more had this kind of problem. This is really astronomical.
Well, and I think for us, it really helps us realize that the problems stemming from ADHD might be more significant than we knew. I mean, problems with reading and with writing, those are essential skills for kids to develop, but also might help us flag children who are having those trouble to maybe start to think about, is ADHD a part of that picture?
Right. We don't want to just berate the child because you're not trying hard enough.
Right.
You need to try harder. But a tutor might be helpful, but also in this particular case, therapy and medication and treatment of the underlying issue might really lead to resolution, because otherwise maybe these children grow up not really learning to read and write because they have problems with it.
And that's really sad.
It is. So important research. Let's try to get more attention to these sorts of therapies. And let's talk about our very next research that matters, about circumcision.
Okay. This is about male circumcision potentially lowering the prevalence of penile precancerous lesions in African men. So this will be hard for me because I do teaching on circumcision and have reviewed this data quite a bit. And, you know, looking at this study, it's one of the pieces of studies that were done in Africa on adolescent and adult men to see if circumcision helps prevent the acquisition of HIV. And so this was a piece of those studies, which we do know reduces by about half the chance of a man in Africa acquiring HIV.
Yeah, and this was actually research done by researchers at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And this is looking at that association with HPV, or the virus that is frequently implicated in penile precancerous and then cancerous lesions. And I was pretty amazed that the overall rate was dramatically lower among those who were circumcised. The percentage of men, of the lesions that had it among those who were not circumcised was 26%. Compared to those that were circumcised, it was less than 1%. That's impressive from the epidemiology or the statistics side of things.
It is, but I still, you know, when I'm teaching this to our residents and talking with parents about this, I think it's important for us to think about that this is different than what we're doing in our country of circumcising babies at birth. These were adult men, and as it relates to the HIV, in really high prevalence areas that are very different than what we see in the United States. And so, and the last data I looked at on HPV, it looked like the number needed to circ was like 100,000 or 200,000 circumcisions to prevent one penile cancer or something in that neighborhood. And so I think we have to just think about this critically.
Well, I think it's giving parents the information, Christy.
Absolutely.
So, and how we do that in absolute terms or in relative terms matters less to me than we give parents full information, particularly if they're really wondering what's right for them and their child here. It's clear that this will reduce their risk, which may be very low, but it would reduce their risk of these sorts of problems. And then there's lots. It's a much more extended conversation. We've talked more about getting an expert on here relating to this issue. I really think we should do it in light of the recent push in California to legislatively eliminate that option for parents.
Well, absolutely, we need to talk about it. I still think, based on all of this, that it's a parent's right to make that decision about how they want their child to look and to have the information that we have and to be supported in that decision whichever way they go.
Agreed. Well, let's talk about this last series of articles. Really all has to do with organ donations. And I think, Christy, you and I both like this research because it was kind of looking at the issue of organ donation and those who live with organ donations from a lot of different viewpoints that maybe influence a lot of our listeners out there. What's our very first one?
Well, there are two of them related to organ donation. One of them is a study looking at or thinking through ways to increase African Americans registering for organ transplantation, considering that they are not as well represented on the national waiting list for being able to have organs to give.
Yeah, and they actually did something that's been done previously in the non-African American population, which is to use, when you sign up to get your license renewal, to have this campaign to try to increase people to agree to have on their license to be organ donors. And so doing an educational campaign at that point in time, when a lot of people hadn't really thought about it, and that's actually when I first thought about it, when I went to get my license 10 years ago. And I said, well, sure, if something happened to me and I was no longer going to be alive and my organs could be used to save a life, that's a no-brainer, pun intended. Sorry about that.
How do I recover from that? We're glad you still have your brain, Adam.
And it worked in this particular study that they actually did increase among this group who's disproportionately underrepresented. So I think this is a good research that can be replicated in many other places.
The other study was trying to examine the decision making between people who are considering giving their organs, and in this case, living kidney donors. We know if you give your kidney when you're alive, then it's much more likely to do someone to benefit someone greater than if you wait until you pass away. So they're looking to try to determine what are the factors and the barriers that contribute to someone giving their kidney.
And this was also in the Journal of Health Communication. And since there's a much greater demand for kidney donors than there is supply, you really do need these living donors out there. And this was interesting about this, Christy, complicated study in some respects because it's very rich, not complicated, but very rich in data. But one thing that really I took home was that a lot of these people who were willing to donate wanted to do it, but they were getting kind of feedback from their family members about reasons they shouldn't donate, that it may not be safe. And so it was causing actually dynamics in the family. Not from the person who was wanting to donate, but from their family members.
From the family members who were concerned about their safety, who maybe had the perception that giving your kidney was really putting your life at risk, and questions there of people not
some of these,
being
some
on
of
board.
Some of these potential donors actually quit talking to some of their family members. So you don't want that to happen. So if you're considering being someone to donate, bring your family in early, get the doctor involved, let them tell your family members that it probably is safe for many people. What about our very last research that matters, Christy?
The last one was trying to examine the experiences of people who have end-stage kidney disease, people who are on dialysis therapy, to try to get an understanding of what their experience is like so that we as nurses and doctors and providers can do a better job caring for them.
Yeah, this was in the journal Medical Humanities, and really using a really interesting theoretical framework, they really kind of talk about how you could spend 9-10 hours a week on dialysis, and that for a lot of people, this can be incredibly boring in terms of the time that you're doing, and that you might feel like you're wasting time. And if we don't talk about that as family members and providers and help people use this time for something that's more productive, then it could be a waste. Even though you stay alive, you don't feel alive.
And I love the study, and as it highlights the importance of us really understanding that experience, that we might, you know, encourage people or help people think about ways to reframe it or think about something to do while they're waiting.
Or hear what waiting is about for people. Yeah. I think it gets me to think that with my patients who are on dialysis, Christy, just to talk more about their life and
what
this
is that
aspect
like?
Of their life. Yep,
mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Well, Christy,
okay.
We've had a chance to talk about listening maybe for people on dialysis.
Talk about organ donation, kidney donation.
A couple different ways. About male circumcision and HPV virus.
And a little bit about kids with ADHD and writing problems. So thank you for being with us for Research That Matters.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with the head of the Faculty of the Medicine's Department of Developmental Biology and Cancer Research at Hebrew University, Dr. Howard Cedar.
Let's do that over.
Sorry. You were supposed to do this one.
Okay. I know. I was looking at the top. It's Chaim.
Okay.
Do you want to go Chaim Cedar or Howard Cedar?
It doesn't make any difference.
Okay.
Okay.
We're going to start there. I'll do
okay.
that.
Okay. Adam, you got it.
Sorry.
Now I'm like pointing. Okay, go.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with the head of the Faculty of the Medicine's Department of Developmental Biology and Cancer Research at Hebrew University, Dr. Howard Cedar, about epigenetics. It's more than just genes. Dr. Cedar is an internationally acclaimed molecular biologist, and his discoveries have earned him the title of the father of DNA methylation, which Christy will have to define and understand and see if Dr. Cedar wants to accept that title. He's also received the Israel Prize and Wolf Prize in Medicine. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Cedar.
Hi.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Cedar. Well, we'll start right where Adam suggested, in that you are called the father of DNA methylation. I guess the question is, do you accept that title, and what does that mean?
I don't know whether I accept the title.
It sounds pretty grand.
Well, first of all, the way, considering my age, it should be the grandfather of methylation, perhaps, not the father.
Well, we do understand you have a few grandchildren, but maybe we'll hear about those later.
Okay. It's true that the whole concept of DNA methylation, which is sort of the beginning of what we call epigenetics, was actually discovered in our laboratories at the Hebrew University. And when I say our laboratories, I'm referring to myself and Dr. Aaron Razin, my partner and collaborator for almost 40 years.
Well, when we talk about research and biological research, maybe we can just back up a step and talk about this field of, and define what is methylation for our listeners. And to my way of understanding, this is, while I studied organic chemistry, and certainly this was part of it, this was not the seemed to be a field of research like it exploded in the last 25 years.
Right. So if we want to understand what DNA methylation is, we have to start with genes. as I'm sure most of your listeners are aware, the human body is composed of cells, and within these cells are a large number of different proteins, which sort of make up the Lego of the body. And these proteins do all of the things that we as a person do. They're responsible for structure and for color and for function, for cells talking to each other, for cell metabolism, enzymes. All of these are accomplished through proteins. And these proteins have to be made by our cells. And in order for them to be made and to be made properly, there's sort of like an instruction booklet in every cell. And this instruction booklet is basically the genes that we receive from our parents. So in every cell, there's this real, it's a booklet in the sense that it contains a language, language with real letters and words and sentences and paragraphs, chapters. And of course, this is a chemical language. This is the language of DNA. And this whole book is put together through these different chemicals, these different letters.
So give us an example of a group of cells in the body and the type of instruction manual that the parents handed down through the genes to tell those cells what to do.
Okay, so perhaps a classical example is everybody has a pigment in the iris of their eyes. So the iris is made up of cells, and within those cells, each one of us makes a protein which is either usually blue or brown. And those proteins are made because within that those same cells, there's this instruction booklet that has one little section, which we call a gene, one little section which gives instructions on how to make this protein. So each one of us is a tiny little bit different. Some of us have instructions that make the protein blue. Some of us have instructions that make the protein brown.
And we're, just so you know, we're sitting here and we're talking with Dr. Cedar, who's in Jerusalem right now. And Christy and I here in Chapel Hill. And Christy has blue eyes and I've got brown eyes. So this is relevant. But so how then does the methylation, the relationship between methylation and this DNA?
Okay. So first of all, we should mention that every cell of the body has this booklet. Incidentally, this booklet, this DNA, is not a minor thing. It's not a little booklet. It's composed of over 3 billion letters, which is the equivalent of about a 50-meter-high stack of encyclopedias.
Yeah.
So it contains a tremendous amount of information. Now, this information is in every cell, and it's in every cell because the first cell of the body, which was made by the sperm fertilizing the egg, that first cell got all the information, half of it from the mother and half of it from the father. And before that cell then divides to make two cells, it copies the information. So that now there are two copies of the information, one for each of the new cells that's going to be formed. And every time cells divide, they do that. They copy the information. And as a result, every cell of the body has this information.
So
every cell has the same information.
Wow.
That's what enables, for instance, the police to be able to identify somebody, whether they have a sample of blood or skin or hair or sperm. It's all the same because it all comes from the same source.
And so how does that then turn into this whole study of epigenetics? How does the methylation in these booklets then relate to this whole field?
Okay. So now there's a little bit of a dichotomy. So if we now take a look at different cells of the body, we see that different cells of the body actually make different proteins. So just for an example, the cells of the iris of the eye makes this eye color protein. But no other cells in the body make this same protein, even though every cell of the body has this information. Because every cell of the body has all of the information, the entire encyclopedia.
But then each one has to learn what part they're supposed to do.
Okay. So the question now is, just to give you another example, let's say nerve cells. Nerve cells make proteins that are transmitters that talk to other nerve cells.
Mm-hmm.
But only nerve cells make that, even though the gene, the information for those transmitters, is present in every cell of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be some way, in a sense, a new additional form of information that instructs cells how to use the booklet that they have. Because in every cell, that booklet is used a little differently. And that's where DNA methylation comes in.
We're talking
during development.
Mm-hmm.
Genes become methylated. Methylation is a chemical modification. So the whole DNA itself is chemical, and this adds another chemical onto that, sort of like a cap on the DNA. And every place where there's DNA methylation, the gene or the part of the book that's methylated can't be read. It's turned off.
Dr. Cedar, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, we really want to pick up with how this methylation and this epigenetics influences the DNA in ways that are promoting health, but also inhibiting health or causing diseases in your research. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Howard Cedar. This is Dr. Adam Goldstein with Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and the NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been having a really interesting conversation with Dr. Howard Cedar from Hebrew University about epigenetics. It's more than just genes. And right before we had to break, Dr. Cedar, you were really describing this linkage between DNA and this process of methylation, and then really think about to tell us then how the epigenetics is involved in turning on or turning off the DNA.
Okay. So what we were saying was that every cell has the same information, have the same genes, but in some cases, the information is methylated. The gene is methylated, and that's a signal to the cell not to read it. And just give you, again, going back to our simple example. So now, if we look inside the cells of the iris of the eye, and we pinpoint the gene for eye color, we'll see that that gene is not methylated. And that's a signal to the cell to read it and make the protein. In contrast, that same gene is located in the liver, in skin cells, in the kidney, everywhere else in the body. the same exact gene, but in those tissues, the gene is methylated. And that's a signal for the cell not to read it, not to use it, not to make the protein.
That can have problems, though, right? I mean, you're assuming that everything's tightly regulated, everything's working perfectly.
Right. And fortunately, it works that way. The regulation is very tight and very clean. And it's sort of like, you know, what would be the equivalent of an annotation. Many times you have a text, similar to the text of the DNA, but a page of text. And you can annotate it. You can underline it or cross things out or put markings on it, which tells you how to read this text. And our genetic information basically is the same way. It can be annotated. It's an additional layer of information that is concerned with the regulation.
So, as you're describing this, I mean, there are billions of parts of this handbook or this booklet that the cells get, and then there's all this regulation of methylation to tell which cells are supposed to use it, not supposed to use the various pieces. And most of the time, it must work because our human bodies function the way they do. But Adam was alluding to the times when it doesn't work, where then we have situations like cancer and other health problems when it doesn't work. Tie this back for us into human health, into the problems that we have like cancer. How does your research help us understand cancer?
So as you can imagine, DNA methylation is a very basic aspect of human biology. And as a result, it's involved in many different diseases. And principally, it's involved in cancer. And so you can understand the significance of it, basically a cancer cell starts off as a normal cell. A cancer cell has basically the same booklet with slight differences in text, very slight. But the cancer cell behaves much differently. And for molecular biologists, when you say a cell behaves differently, it means it's making different proteins. And that comes about because there are massive changes in DNA methylation in the cancer cell. Part of the cancer process is changes in methylation, changes in the epigenetics, changes in the annotation of the cell.
We're talking with Dr. Howard Seder of Hebrew University about epigenetics and cancer and disease. And Dr. Seder, I guess one of the things I found startling in just reading a little bit about your work is this idea of looking not just at the gene level, but looking how the environment of a person really interacts with the influence in epigenetics and in altering the expression. Can you talk a little bit about some of the research that you and your group has looked at, how the environment or what we know about how environment influences this genetic expression?
Yeah, sure. And actually, we haven't done very much research on this. It's sort of a new concept. The idea is that it's very clear that methylation can easily change the way genes behave. Just like, for instance, a genetic disease where there's a mistake in the text can affect the organism, presumably by changing methylation, you can change the way the genes are used, and that can affect the human being in many ways. And I say this a little bit theoretically because there really is no hard proof that this occurs to any appreciable extent. Many of us assume that this occurs. It's very reasonable that it occurs, that things in the environment can affect our genes, not by changing the text, by changing the way the genes are used, by changing the annotation.
Do you think it's possible I mean, along that same line, is it possible that our cancer treatments in the future, because of your research with methylation, that we'd be able to turn these cancer cells off?
Yeah, I think this is a... You see, one of the things about cancer is that the more we get to the basic defect in cancer, the easier it will be to approach the disease either by looking for a treatment or by looking for some way of preventing the disease. And DNA methylation really stands at the foundation of cancer.
Well, I understand it's also linked with diabetes as well.
Well, I think it's sort of linked indirectly to diabetes. But there is a link in the sense that, first of all, it could be linked to adult diabetes, to type 2 diabetes, okay, where many people think that perhaps in addition to genetic effects, there are also epigenetic effects, that things from the environment can affect people and make them prone to diabetes, or perhaps even the opposite, help protect them from diabetes. It's certainly a possibility.
And what about this, because we're just paying attention to a little bit of our time, but the diagnosis of disease, because I've read that this work in epigenetics might also involve not only new drugs, but new ways to potentially diagnose diseases earlier, like prostate cancer. Is this reality or is this fiction?
I think that this is a little bit of both. There is no question that DNA methylation can be used to detect both the existence of cancer and the type of cancer, the degree, the grade of the cancer. It's a very useful tool for that. Whether it can be used as a methodology that is better in the sense that you can see it earlier, I'm not positive. I don't know. But that's a possibility.
Well, Dr. Cedar, looking ahead at how your research is impacting human health and helping us figure it out, what do you think is the next development on the horizon that will help improve health?
I think that one of the important things about DNA methylation is the whole concept of stem cells. So if you think about stem cells are basically cells that haven't been programmed into a cell type yet. And so they have sort of a primitive or a basic methylation pattern. And they haven't been programmed yet. And I think one of the big things today in medicine is this regenerative medicine field, where people are trying to take stem cells and sort of program them in the test tube to be different cell types, which can then be used in medicine. But this process is not completely understood yet. And one of the major elements of this understanding is understanding these switches. How do you put on and turn off these switches so that the cells will behave the way you want them to? And this is an important area where DNA methylation is going to play a very, very big role.
Well, Dr. Cedar, I can't thank you enough for sharing not only your research and making it in ways that I know Christy and I could at least understand it.
Thank you. But
for all our listeners. And you know, I think Christy started off by saying you have been given the title of grandfather of methylation. I think you have how many grandchildren? 12?
Yeah, 13.
Well, that's a wonderful symbolic number, and we know that the work that you're doing and turning on and turning off signals, you're annotating billions of books and billions of DNAs for people in the future. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Cedar. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment, Adam and I are going to answer some fantastic questions related to your questions and concerns.
Yeah, Christy, we have questions today about going to the bathroom and getting up at night, about teeth turning yellow,
about joints damaged and how to prevent it, and about colds.
Preventing common colds. I want to protect my joints. I don't want my teeth to be yellow. I definitely don't want to get colds, and I don't like getting up to go to the bathroom at night. So these are relevant to me.
Tell us all about it, Adam.
No. I don't have all of them, but we would like to hear from our listeners, and you can send your own comments to us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
Let's take our first question.
Hello. I was wondering if you should have cause for concern if you have to get up several times during the evening to go to the bathroom.
So this is about, the fancy word for this is nocturia.
Or just getting up at night to go to the bathroom.
To go to the bathroom, exactly.
And should you be concerned about it? Absolutely.
Well, and that word nocturia is applied if you wake up more than two or more times at night to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, a lot of people have to get up at night to go to the bathroom. But, you know, once is typical. If you're doing it two or more times, as Christy, you just mentioned, it could be, I mean, it calls for concern. Well, you're concerned. And, you know, if I were getting up twice a night or three times a night, I wouldn't be sleeping so good. So that is concerning.
It is. And if you're a man, you know, one common reason is when your prostate can get enlarged, something called BPH, and cause you to need to get up multiple times in the night.
And I'm not going to share this one with our listeners,
I think,
Christy.
That's really wise.
But what's important to understand is that there is, even for men who have this prostatic hypertrophy, there are things they can do about it other than medications. And the thing that we recommend initially is the same thing we recommend for women who sometimes are having problems controlling the urine. It's what's called Kegel exercises, to really squeeze the muscles around the lower abdomen, around the prostate and the groin.
And other reasons that people get up at night to go to the bathroom can be problems with their sleep. So getting up can cause you to have problems with sleep, but having problems with sleep can also...
You're up and all of a sudden I got to go to the bathroom there.
Having just your age. If you drink a lot of fluids at night before you go to bed, you're going to get up. And I have a lot of patients who are drinking alcohol right before bed and then coming in worried about getting up at night. And certainly
alcohol is a diuretic.
It sure is.
Has diuretic-like properties. Well, hopefully that gives you some things. I'd say we're concerned, but if you're concerned, we're concerned. We hope we can get this under treatment for you. What's our very next house call?
What causes teeth to stain and turn yellow?
Well, I like having white teeth, and I have to work at it because I'm a coffee drinker, and that's certainly one thing that can stain your teeth over time.
And it's not just coffee. It's coffee and tea and soda and wine. Sometimes certain fruits and vegetables even can have staining properties. Beets, for instance, that'd be more purple than it would be yellow.
And there are also certain enamel problems, and just the way teeth are formed. This sometimes happens in children where the teeth can look more yellow.
And you know what one of the most common ones, Christy, is in a lot of our patients, unfortunately.
Fluorosis?
That can do white. That can do white staining. But people who smoke cigarettes.
Oh, yeah.
The nicotine and the residue you can just tell a smoker sometimes because the teeth are yellow. So, you know, it's lots of different things. Even poor hygiene can sometimes cause bacteria and plaque that can cause discoloration.
And there are kits that you can buy over the counter now, or certainly through your dentist, where there are teeth whitening treatments that do make a difference. And it may be something that you have to do more often. Certainly, if you're doing one of these things or ingesting a lot of coffee or smoking cigarettes or something, that will continue to stain your teeth.
And there's a couple medications that we really want to avoid in young children underneath the age of 8, the tetracyclines and doxycyclines. Those can cause teeth staining. Typically, that's more of a greenish color. But certainly in any a young child, talk before they give you antibiotics or drugs about this as potential one side effect.
Let's take our next house call.
How can I protect my joints from damage?
Well, how can you protect from joints from damage? Well, I think probably wear a helmet, put a concrete barrier in front of you, and don't do anything.
Well, okay.
Short of that.
Short of that. I mean, the best thing, big picture, is to keep a healthy weight. That's one thing, is a lot of people have damage in their joints from having something called osteoarthritis, which is often related to being overweight. So keeping a healthy weight, keeping your muscles strong, wearing proper shoes, just some of those basic things to try to keep yourself healthy.
Yeah, well, and the joints are an overuse and an overstress. So you mm-hmm. talk about the overstress from excess weight frequently.
Sure.
But the overuse can also be there. I have a friend who recently, after not exercising for, you know, a couple of years, went out and started exercising a whole bunch and then had started developing problems with their knees. And so you got to go slow and start slow sometimes to build up that endurance.
I think it's wonderful that you're thinking ahead and thinking about prevention, because that's, you know, that's really the mainstay of how Adam and I think about things, to try to keep people healthy. So you have the right framework in mind, and I commend you for your question.
Yeah. Sometimes maybe meet with a physical therapist. If you're starting an exercise regimen and you really want to protect your joints, meet with the physical therapist and go over the stretching exercises that you can also do for to lower your chance of damage.
Of injury,
good,
for sure.
Good question. And what's our very last house call question today, Christy?
With cold season coming up, what is the best treatment for a cold?
Achoo.
Ah, Gesundheit. God bless you. But you don't have a cold because I'm sitting here looking at you. And if you were sneezing, you probably sneeze in groups of two or three or four. What's your sneezing pattern?
I'm not a big sneezer. I'm usually just a one.
Oh, really? Because I always do three. So I don't know why it is, but some people have these patterns here. And the common cold is probably one of the most common miserable things that people have to seemingly endure for 3 to 5 days, two or three times a year for a lot of people.
And, you know, the treatment, I mean, we should talk about prevention being wash your hands. But the treatment, it's a little frustrating because we as doctors don't have a magic pill to treat this virus. It comes and it works through your system and it goes. So really it's about drinking fluids and taking medicine over the counter kind of thing if you're aching and having certain symptoms that can help, but it doesn't actually treat the cold.
Right. The symptomatic therapy, there is some evidence that things like those decongestant nose drops or the saline nose drops, or there are some medicines that you can get by prescription, some nasal sprays by prescription, not steroids, interesting, but some other ones that can provide some symptomatic benefit.
For most folks, it's just a matter of waiting it out and let your body fight it. And we hope that through hand washing this year that you won't have as many colds to suffer from.
But one thing we don't recommend for most common colds is that you take antibiotics, because that's not going to help and it'll breed resistance. And we also don't recommend in general antihistamines, because there's really no good evidence that those really provide a benefit. Some people, though, Christy, do swear by vitamin C. Do you take vitamin C when you get a cold?
I don't. I do actually increase my this is not evidence-based, but I do increase my vitamin D a little bit when I get a cold because of the sort of loose studies about it being helpful for immunity. But I don't take vitamin C.
Yeah, the data on that is not very good. The only people who seem to benefit from vitamin C are your endurance athletes who are in extreme cold conditions. So if when you go up to Alaska, Christy, and you're doing the Alaska dog race,
good
sled
advice.
Race, that's a place to maybe take vitamin C for prevention.
All right. So we have had a chance to talk about the common cold, about trying to prevent your joints from damage,
about things that can cause the teeth to stain different colors and ways of preventing that.
And a little bit about something called nocturia, or getting up to go to the bathroom at night.
Well, that'll conclude the research, the house call section of our show, as well as your health today. We hope that we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. And you can send us your own concerns at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can follow us on our blog at yourhealthradio.org, on Twitter, Facebook, and now iTunes.
And we'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We will look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.